And Aida is eager to open up.
I am indeed, Andreas, and thank you. And good morning still, everyone. We have three nice and easy papers for you today on primary financial statements, all relating to classification of income and expenses, and lots to do with the financing category. So without further ado, I would just like to hand over to Anne to introduce the first paper, 21A, and we'll be taking them in order afterwards. So thank you, and over to you, Anne.
Thanks, Aida. Morning, everybody. Agenda paper 21A looks at the classification of income and expenses in the financing category in profit or loss. It explores the approach that we put before the board in May in the light of feedback from the board at that meeting. The paper discusses the classification of income and expenses in the financing category for entities without the specified main business activities, i.e. for basically non-financial entities. And we'll discuss the classification of income and expenses for financial entities at a future meeting. So the approach set out in agenda paper 21A of the May board meeting was to distinguish between liabilities that arise from transactions that involve only the raising of finance, for which all income and expenses would be classified in the financing category, and other liabilities, for which only specified income and expenses would be classified in the financing category. The May paper also recommended that liabilities that arise from transactions that involve only the raising of finance would be described as transactions that involve the receipt by the entity of cash, a reduction in a financial liability or an entity's own equity, and the return by the entity of cash or the entity's own equity. And in this paper, we describe these conditions as the cash own shares criteria. So in response to feedback from the board, we've analysed the income and expenses that arise under IFRS standards that cover liabilities to identify what would be classified in the financing category applying that approach. In that analysis, we've assumed that the board will not specifically require an entity to disaggregate income and expenses beyond the requirements of those standards just for the purpose of classifying income and expenses in the financing category. And I'll come back to that assumption later when we talk about what income expenses to classify in the financing category for liabilities that don't arise from transactions that involve only the raising of finance. So our analysis is set out in Appendix A of the paper. We conclude that the criteria in the May board paper work well for all liabilities other than possibly hybrid contracts with host liabilities and an embedded derivative. And for such contracts, the existence of the embedded derivative raises questions about whether the application of this cash and shares criteria always gives an appropriate outcome. However, we further concluded from our analysis that if the embedded derivative was separated from the host liability applying IFRS 9, the approach developed in the May paper works well when applied to the host liability, leaving the separated derivative to be treated in the same way as any other derivative, and derivatives are discussed in Agenda Paper 21B. So we were left with the question of what to do with hybrid contracts that are not separated applying IFRS 9. And I now know more about these contracts than I did before. It's been quite an exploration for me, I have to say. An analysis of the income and expenses that arise on such contracts is set out in Appendix B. Now, the possibilities for classifying such income and expenses are constrained because it's not possible to disaggregate the income and expenses into amounts that relate to the host and amounts that relate to the embedded derivative. So we have to think about classifying the entire amount of each item of income and expense that arises from these contracts. That led us to conclude that the simplest approach that also gives the best outcomes is to classify income and expenses from such hybrid contracts, applying the same approach as applies to other liabilities, i.e. essentially to disregard the effect of the embedded derivative in determining whether the liability arises from a transaction that involves solely the raising of finance. So the first set of questions for the board are set out after paragraph 52 of the paper. Questions 1 and 2 cover confirmation of the approach in the May board paper to everything other than hybrid contracts. And question 3 covers the treatment of hybrid contracts. And with that, I'll hand the discussion over to the board.
Thank you, Anne. Sue, please.
Thanks, Andreas. And thanks for the paper. I was a bit like a pig in mud, which probably should worry you, Anne. Structure, you know, bankers delight this paper. There's quite a few things I agree with and I like, and a couple of suggestions and comments and observations. So what I think this is an improvement on what we had last time, so thank you. And I think much of what you have proposed in here addresses some of the concerns that I had last time, so I'll start with that. And so focusing on the bits that I think I support and then raising a couple of observations. So I think what is good in here is proposing a sort of specific definition of what only financing means, with this sort of very simple approach that's in 51B. That's a bit of a blunt instrument, but it's very clear, and I think it's a logical basis. So I like that. So I think that's a good addition. I also very much agree with where you get to in 52A and B. So the idea that a separated liability would be sort of treated in the same way as a sort of standalone instrument. I think that makes sense because the process of separation means that what's left behind is pretty vanilla. I also agree with the treatment of separated embedded derivatives for two reasons. One, it's consistent with how we approach embeds elsewhere. Typically, once you separate an embedded, we treat it as a standalone derivative for hedging purposes and all those sorts of purposes. So it's consistent with the logic elsewhere in our literature. Also, if you look at the criteria we have in IFRS 9, which we inherited from 39, about when you separate embedded derivatives, I think about it very simplistically. It's trying to identify things that don't look like natural parts of an instrument. They're funny bits. And so taking them out and thinking about them separate from the host, to me, makes sense because it follows the logic of why they're separable in our criteria for embeds anyway. So for those two reasons, I very much agree with that proposal of the stuff. So that's all good. Obviously, the trickier bit is where you have things that aren't separated. And I had to build myself a little table to work out what all of this meant to help me just with my logic. And I think the conclusion I came to is probably two main observations. I think for me, it matters why you end up with something that's not separated. So some things aren't separated because you've got an embedded derivative, but it's so benign that it's not separable. So it's you know, inflation linked or something, but it's not that unusual, so it's not separated. And I'll come back to that camp when we get to the later questions in the paper. Those, I think, are fairly benign instruments. But the other piece of the other category that you can have in this category of things that are hybrids that aren't separated is the really funky stuff, to use a technical term. So you've got a derivative that's weird enough that it would be separated, but you've chosen to use the fair value option. So you've chosen to treat it as a whole and measure it at fair value through profit or loss. So you've made that choice. Now, the thing I do agree with in the staff analysis is not getting into slicing and dicing those instruments. It's not something that IFRS 9, I'll say, contemplates. It certainly doesn't require it, nor does it contemplate it. Personally, I'd go so far as not to allow it either, because people will do weird stuff when they slice and dice things. So I agree with keeping it together as a whole. That part I agree with. But the thing that makes me hesitate is that we're going to get really different outcomes depending on whether you have got, say, a loan with these funny feet, like a loan for cash, repaid in cash, so only financing, that's got these funny features in it, or if you'd say have vendor financing that's got these funny features in it. So if it's just a cash instrument and it's got, I don't know, a link to gold prices, it's going to be put into the financing category. All those remeasurements will go in the financing category. But if I go and buy a big truck and I convince the vendor to give me a loan and it's linked to gold prices, then the whole thing is going to go to operating. And that really matters because the operating subtotal is a really, really important metric. Now, you might say, well, how many people are going to buy a truck and get a gold link in it? And my reaction would be, yeah, probably not many people, until they realize that they can get a really different operating profit metric if they do that. And so people could do things like go to their truck manufacturer and say, could you do this gold-linked loan, get everything into operating, and then say, and by the way, here's an investment bank that's willing to swap those cash flows back to vanilla cash flows for you. I mean, that stuff will happen. You know, we have to be alive to structuring opportunities when we've got such different outcomes and when a metric like operating profit is involved. Now, does that mean that I think we should do something different to what you've got in the paper? So it's a very long story, sorry. For those instruments that are fair value options, so it's a separable derivative, but somebody's chosen not to separate it. So it's a funky derivative. I think it's okay for it actually to have this binary outcome, because hopefully it won't happen that often and there won't be too many instruments somebody has to play with that's going to have those sorts of features, because they're not cash instruments, they're vendor financing type things. That's the shorthand I use. But what I think we should do is make sure there's enough transparency and disclosure around those funny instruments that have fair value options, separable derivatives that have moved to operating, that if an investor wants to actually take out an interest piece or move it to financing, they've got the information they need to do that reclassification. So I'm okay with this. I'm going to come back to the closely related stuff later because I've got different worries about that. But for the separable derivatives that are not only financing, so they're not just cash instruments, and where they are separable derivatives and the fair value option has been used, I think we should make sure there's transparency and disclosure around that. And I don't think that will be too onerous, because it should be relatively rare instrument where that happens. And I think it would help investors rejig things if they want to, because as a consequence, there's no interest expense or anything in the financing section on that sort of instrument, just because it's measured at fair value through profit or loss.
Thank you, Sue. Tadeo.
Thank you, Andreas. And thank you to the staff for preparing and coming back with this paper. So very good, comprehensive, and dealing with very important issues in our project. In relation to the classification of the gains and losses with derivatives embedded in financial liabilities, when this is included in a transaction where hedge accounting is applied, it would be easier to track the objective of this, as there wouldn't have a documentation to support it. But this is not always the case when this is used, for example, to hedge, but without applying hedge accounting. And my comment is a more generic comment, not only for this one, but as we have in some cases for the same kind of expenses, different classification. And when this classification is not straightforward, I'm wondering whether we would add some wording such as supportable, not to say document, approach to avoid opportunistic classification. I think that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Tadeo. Let's hear from Bertrand.
Thank you, Andres. First of all, I would like to thank the staff for their patience with me in getting me in this project when we had the inducement meetings. So thanks to you guys. A comment I shared with them, something that's because we as far as I understood the paper, what we are trying to see is the financing category classification. So what we put in financing, and something that strikes me is that something may miss if we classify the interest and income on cash and cash equivalents as investing and not as financing. Two comments, if I may add. The first is, I think what surprised me the most is that the cash equivalence is are defined in IS 7, paragraph 7, as being held for the purpose of meeting short-term cash commitments rather than for investment or other purposes. So if it's not investment, if it's not held for the purpose of investing, so why should we classify those as investing rather than as financing? And if it's for the purpose of meeting short-term cash commitments, it means that then it has more, to me, the nature of financing elements rather than investing. And the second thing is, by experience, having worked on those issues with the Treasury Department of my former employer, I well know that there is only when you invest in a cash equivalent instruments or in a financial asset, whether you will classify it as cash equivalents or not, of course. The key issue is liquidity versus return. So I'm not saying that in the current era, we are, Treasury Department is seeking for high returns. It does not exist any longer, above all for short-term instruments. But at least the arbitrage they will perform is really on instant liquidity. And so they will sacrifice the return then. It could be even negative in the current environment of the rates. And so then if it's the case, I would presume that it meets the definition of a cash equivalence in most instances. And it has more the feature or the nature of a financing element than of an investing element, because we are not the Treasury Department is not seeking for any specific return. On the other hand, if it's the other way around, sacrificing the liquidity and in order to obtain a higher return or maybe a less worse return than for more liquid instruments, then of course it's likely that those financial assets won't meet the definition of cash equivalence and could be regarded effectively as being there for investment purposes rather than for just liquidity purposes. So I wanted to make this remark because I was very surprised by the fact that interest and income on cash and cash equivalent would be or could be classified as investing and disregarded from the financing section. And I see really from my previous experience, a clear distinction between liquidity or investing in an instrument with the purpose of seeking a return, sacrificing the liquidity versus effectively having an instrument available at any time to meet short-term cash commitment, hence to finance the working cap or whatever of a company. So just wanted to make this general comment.
Thank you. Mary, please.
Okay. I feel a bit at risk commenting in this area because it's one I'm less comfortable about, but I wanted to flag a few things that were important to me as I worked through this analysis. One is to say I agree with your assumption conclusion that we should not require for presentation purposes any disaggregation beyond that required in other standards. So I think that's the right, that's a good anchor and we should stick with that. And then the second thing, and I think this echoes something that Sue said, I think we should be clear that we are talking about classification of the entire item, and not only do we not require any further disaggregation, that we don't permit any further disaggregation than other standards permit. So for, and this is, I'm getting in really thin ice here. So if we have an item for which an entity is elected to use the fair value option, the changes in fair value would not be disaggregated into, let's say, a notional interest amount and a notion, you know, and other amounts that we are talking about classifying the whole thing. If we specify any exceptions, that we would do so explicitly. And I also agree with your conclusion that we should not try to write special criteria for unseparated derivatives, you know, do a whole new standard setting project within this presentation project. So that was another thing that seemed to me like a good anchor. I have a question, and I'm feeling as I get to something that's a bit more solid ground for me, IS-37. I was trying to think about whether there ever would be a time that interest expense on a provision that's within the scope of IS-37 would be regarded as related to operating rather than to financing. And I couldn't think of a time, but I wanted to ask the staff to think about it, because if we think it should not happen, then I think we should make an observation comment along those lines. So that was it in terms of reactions on the first group of questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I just respond to that sort of question from Mary? I mean, we certainly, the way we've set it up, we would be saying that interest on IS liabilities, the unwinding of the discount, would always be in financing. And I think that's sort of quite an important aspect of the whole way we've approached it, is we've said we don't need to try and identify liabilities that relate to financing activities, which is really sort of problematic to do because of the different views that people have. What we're focusing on is what income and expenses should be in the financing category. And that means you get all the income and expenses on liabilities that are solely financing, but you also do pull in income and expenses on other liabilities that are essentially financing in nature, and that would include the interest expense on IS-37 liabilities. So it's fundamental to this approach that we would never regard that interest expense as being operating. That's what makes the approach work.
And I was trying to think about it in the context of thinking about distinguishing the other reasons that the IS-37 liability changes, you know, changes in estimates, changes in discount rates, et cetera. I'm a big believer not in excessive guidance, et cetera, but that subtlety is overrated when it comes to nuances like this, and we might want to think about commenting very directly and explicitly about that. And you know, perhaps it's more a basis for conclusion comment about why we didn't feel it was necessary to do more specific standard setting because of the way that the application of the general approach works when you get to IS-37. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Rika, please.
Thank you, Andreas, and thank you, staff. On the previous meeting's paper, I had a concern from practitioner about the definition of only the raising of finance, because that limit only the receipt by the entity of cash, not including other assets. So maybe that person's concern is there are a wide variety of the other assets is possibly used for financing objective for some entities. But I think how the staff try to articulate and then make our draft requirement clearly is possibly, I feel the intention of this improvement will work in practice. Because I think how you articulate and how you require that classification is try to provide more clarity where necessary and not try not to disrupt the existing classification in practice too much by using the existing standards requirement in the IFRS. So I think if our intention is properly interpreted and understood in the practice, I don't think that we face a lot of serious concern about applying this approach. But if possible, I would like to ask the staff to ask some preparers if our intention will be understood properly in the practice and this can work as we expect. I don't think I don't ask you to do the extensive outreach, but just ask some participants of the feedback or some preparers that suffice. Thank you.
Thank you, Rika. Nick, please.
Thank you, and thanks to the staff for this paper. For me, this built on obviously the May paper, but also added clarity to the proposals in that paper. Rather like Rika, I had concerns around the definition of transactions that only involve the raising of finance and the potential that those would rule out certain scenarios that I think as being finance or having an interest component. But with the analysis that you've included in the appendix, and particularly paragraph 7A2, make it clear about interest expense and the effect of changes in interest rates where such items are identified, applying the requirements of IFRS standards, brought some clarity and comfort to me about the approach. So I think that does now work for me. I was interested clearly in Sue's comment around the funky derivatives. Let's use that terminology. And I would be wary of trying to adjust the proposals as they stand to, you know, which would potentially bring more complexity, but actually some disclosure here. I think that would be a welcome addition. I mean, I don't see it happening very often, so hopefully it's not burdensome, certainly to the universe of preparers. But just to put up a flag that say something else is going on here, I can only see that as being positive.
Thank you, Nick. Before we get to the voting on the questions, can I make a comment too? And that builds a bit on Sue's, Rika's, and Nick's comments. I think for me, whenever it comes to separating out embedded derivatives, this should not necessarily equate to can't be financing. I think the separation requirement that we inherited from IAS 39 were not written with a view of is this operating, financing, or investing? The meaning was different. It was financing versus held for trading. But held for trading doesn't equate necessarily to operating. So if you think about a corporate that raised finance and had some funky derivatives, to use the technical term, built in there, but the purpose of that was really not to disregard the financing view, but rather to say, let's work on the conditions that are attached to that finance to make it cheaper or in certain circumstances more expensive. That doesn't change the nature of the instrument at all. And whether you keep it as one or whether you separate it out should not give a different answer, I think. So I would actually echo Rika's comment in saying it would be good to actually test this with preparers. But if we say preparers, I would say don't go to the accounting department. Go to the financing and the treasury department. because that are the guys that actually are caring about the financing. And I would not like to see us prescribing a set of requirements that would talk to our general model, but would be perceived inconsistent by those that are actually dealing with the financing part in entities. So in a nutshell, I see the structuring point that this paper tries to address. So if you do have a derivative that was split out, it should not be treated differently to any other freestanding derivative. I get that point. Yet on the other hand, I think that there is a difference between a derivative that has been split out from a compound instrument vis-a-vis a freestanding derivative that never belonged to any other contract. I think we ought to be careful that we are not trying to over-engineer something for purity purposes or for conceptual brightness. And don't get me wrong that these comments are meant derogatory in any way. But I just think that we ought to keep really practice in mind and say, is this really something extra that's going on and that shouldn't go into the financing function? Or is that still something that could be regarded as being part of financing? I see a number of comments on this one, Anne, Bertrand, and Sue. So Anne, please.
Should I be the first or Anne, do you have a comment?
Anne, please, yes. She has lost connection. Then Bertrand, you probably go first, yeah. And then we have Sue, and then we
have Anne. Sure. What you said on seeking the feedback from alongside the accounting department, not just the accounting department, but also the treasurers or the treasury departments of a company is also important. That's exactly why I made the comments on cash and cash equivalents and the fact that I think that from a pure treasurer's perspective, the interest and income that are linked to cash and cash equivalents for them it's a pure financing element, and they will deal with it to set their own financial results, and we are then mechanically creating a reconciling item between the aggregates that are followed by a treasury department and the gap measures that the accountants would be required to follow if cash and cash interest and income and cash equivalents would fall into the investing category. So we're mechanically internal to a company create a reconciling item there. Because that's why I agree with your comment, Andreas, that it's really important to, on those issues, discuss with treasury departments.
Thank you. Sue, you want to come in?
Yes, sure. So on this point, just a couple of thoughts, and also sort of thinking back to the discussion we had last time. So I, of course, getting the view from, you know, other parts of businesses is very useful. And I think as a general proposition, we're introducing quite a few new ideas in here. So we'll need to find a way to make sure these people understand this and it all works just more generally anyway. But just focusing on the separable and separated embedded derivatives point just for a moment. If I understand correctly, the idea would be that there is already a link into the sort of treasury, etc., because we're already saying that if you were using the derivative for risk management, etc., that would feed into the other paper we're going to discuss, if I understand correctly. So there is already some link there. So maybe the way to think about it would be to make sure that that discussion, you know, sort of works properly, if you like, for separated derivatives in the way it does for embedded. Just build on Andreas's point, but sort of building on the paper that we've got before us. And I guess the thing that I would like to just be careful that we don't get back into is the nice thing, I think, about what the staff has proposed here is, if you remember the comments that I made at the last meeting, I was a bit worried about debating with people, you know, when they think something's to do with financing and not to do with financing and only financing, or is it something else? And I think the nice thing about the staff proposals here is this focus on, is it sort of a loan where you get cash and you repay in cash or your own shares, is a nice sort of bright way, bright line-ish way, but a clear way of identifying which camp you're in. And I guess I'd be keen not to get back into a debate about, do you think this derivative is to do with financing or not? Because it sort of gets us back into that sort of territory again. So I guess totally agree we should make sure we're talking to the right parts of organisations to make sure people think this makes sense. But I'd be keen to think if we can build on the risk management ideas that we've got rather than introducing another new concept if we possibly could, just as a suggestion.
Point taken. Anne, you want to come in?
Are you talking to me or Anne Tarker?
I'm talking to you.
Right. Thank you, but no, I don't think so. I mean, we are planning to do some outreach to make sure that, you know, these new ideas work, and I think it's a great idea to, you know, talk to Treasury people as well as financial reporting people, and certainly we would pick up on the ideas of disclosure that Sue and Nick raised. But, you know, other than that, I suppose just one point. Mary was talking about disaggregation, and I would say that I don't want at this point to talk about whether we, you know, when we would require or maybe prohibit disaggregation. We'll talk about that in when we talk about disaggregation principles at a future board meeting. But what we did want to sort of establish in this paper is that even if you did voluntary disaggregation, sort of whatever that might mean, we would not want that to flow through to presentation. So you could in the notes disclose, you know, whatever breakdown you think is material, but if that breakdown is in addition to what is sort of specifically set out by the requirements of the standard, it wouldn't affect the presentation. And we think that because the structure of the statement of profit or loss, a lot of it is about giving a common structure and comparability, and we don't want choices about how you might disaggregate for disclosure purposes to affect that comparability in terms of what gets into operating and what gets into financing.
Andreas, can I just confirm that my comment was in the context of presentation? So it was saying that having followed the other standards to determine what is the required disaggregation, you are then presenting the whole of the required disaggregation. You know, we're applying these requirements to the whole of the required disaggregation, not permitting further disaggregation for presentation purposes.
Yeah, that's exactly what we want to achieve, yeah.
Okay. With that, are we then ready to vote on the first set of questions? Question one, do we agree with the staff recommendation? And just to remind board members of what Anne said, the question one and question two is basically a reaffirmation of the decisions that have been taken in the May meeting. So on question one, does the board agree with the staff recommendation? Can I see a show of hands, please?
12.
Neely, you get used to that, right?
That's right.
Question two, do we agree with the board recommendation?
Bertrand, is your hand down? Okay, 11.
Yes, my hand is down because I think it will miss the interest and income on cash and cash equivalents.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And question three, do we agree with the... With the caveats that we have fleshed out in the discussion, do we agree with the staff recommendation to the proposal of hybrid contracts? Can I see a show of hands, please?
12.
Okie dokie. All right. Back to you, Anne, for the second part.
Great. Thank you very much. So the final question for the board is, what items of income and expenses should be classified in the financing category for the liabilities that don't arise from a transaction that solely involves the raising of finance? So these are transactions where we're not saying there's nothing to do with financing in them. We know that it's a combination of activities going on there. There's something that is financing and there's something that isn't financing. Now, as I noted earlier, and going back to Mary's point, for this purpose, we've assumed the board won't add specific disaggregation requirements for the purpose of classifying income and expenses in the financing category. So we'll just be using the analysis that IFRS standards currently require. And on that basis, we concluded from the analysis that we did that requiring classification in the financing category of something labelled interest expense and the effect of changes in interest rates when identified applying the requirements of IFRS standards captures the right population. And that recommendation is set out in question 4, which is after paragraph 60 of the paper. So I will hand over to the board for discussion.
Thank you. I see, can I comment, please? Is that from Sue? Because I can't see.
Yeah, sorry. See it. All right. Sorry, you're sick of the sound of my voice. I said I was going to come back on these instruments where you've got an embedded derivative, but where the requirements in IFRS 9 would mean that you don't, they're not separable. So this is, you know, benign derivatives as opposed to funky derivatives. I wonder whether we would be better when these instruments are measured at amortized cost just to say that all income and expenses should be in financing. And I say that for two reasons. One is that I think that the sorts of income and expenses that you're going to get over and above interest is going to be pretty close to being financing in nature because they've come through the criteria in IFRS 9, which is screened whether they're closely related or not. And at 30,000 feet, that's a test for whether that looks like a natural feature to have in a financial instrument. So an example of what I'm talking about here would be I buy a truck. That's always going to be my example. I buy a truck from somebody. They give me vendor financing and I've got the right for 3 years and I've got the right to prepay that loan. Technically speaking, that prepayment option makes that a hybrid contract and it's not going to be separable if there's nothing special about that prepayment feature. If I have a change in whether I think I'm going to prepay or not, I need to re-estimate my cash flows and that causes P&L amounts to flow through. And that seems pretty financing related to me. You know, I decided to prepay my loan. I didn't think I would originally. That seems so benign that asking somebody to strip that out and think about putting that in operating and putting the interest expense in financing just feels like more work than what it's worth, to be honest. And it's not a population that's hard to identify. It's not a hard thing to draft. I've got a closely related derivative and it's measured at amortized cost. The other reason why I think it would be helpful to do that, in addition to the fact that these are going to be, I think, pretty much routinely very close to normal financing-y sort of things, is because I'm worried we're going to reopen a whole debate that's a whole series of practice issues about what's interest and what's not interest in amortized cost mechanics in IFRS 9. So, for example, at the moment, we've got a live question at the Interpretations Committee about how you deal with adjustments in margin in some cases when it's not part of the market interest rate or could be considered that way. And we've got a question that came to the Interpretations Committee, must have been in 2004, 2005, that's never been answered, about inflation-linked things. And I'm not sure, if somebody asked me if an adjustment in the carrying amount caused by changes in inflation is interest related or not on an inflation linked instrument, I'm not sure I'd know the answer to that question. I can skip that question by just saying all of the income and expenses on an amortized cost instrument that's closely related goes into financing, because then any adjustment to do with inflation is just going to get swept into the financing part. It's just going to be easier for people to do, I think. And also it's going to be a pretty clean cut because we've got the benefit of the filter for the closely related criteria. And it's going to just save us a whole series of application questions about what's interest related and what isn't. And so I just think for that subset, I'd be keen just to say, let's just stick everything, not just interest related, into the financing section, because it's just going to be easier to apply, easy to understand, and a clearer cut. I know it's an extra bit of drafting because it's different to a different population, but I think the application will be easier for people.
If I could just respond, I mean, I think that's a really interesting example, and it's not one I'd thought about, the one about the prepayment option, because I can completely see that if you're just getting, like, the change in timing of a payment rather than a change in the payment itself, or you know, does seem like a... yeah, I agree. It seems like financing, and I hadn't thought about how that would be captured. The example about inflation is also interesting and sort of leads into the explanation of why the team had thought that we wouldn't maybe include these changes other than sort of interest expense and the effect of changes in discount rates. Because if you think about, for example, IAS 37, there, in fact, you have a choice whether to include the effects of inflation in the cash flows or in the discount rate. And that means applying our recommendation. You know, you would get a different answer as to what goes into operating and what goes into financing, depending on how you did that calculation. Because if you put the effect of inflation into the cash flow estimates, we wouldn't pick it up in financing. If we put it into the discount rate, you would. And that, I agree, is, you know, that having that choice and that the outcome of that choice is unfortunate. But, you know, it is a result of what's in IAS 37. And we as a team certainly didn't feel able that we would... if we contrast that with IFRS 17, which sets out principles about how you identify what should be shown as insurance finance income and expense, compared to what sort of is treated as a sort of underwriting expense. There we try and identify the things that are changes in financial assumptions from things that are changes in other sorts of assumptions. And we did get questions, and we continue to get questions. And I see that is a very sort of difficult split sometimes to identify. And I would not want to try and do that across all our standards. I think that would be way outside the scope of the project. And so I suppose that was why we thought here, the sort of the simplest approach to the hybrid contracts was the embedded derivatives, was just to say, look, we know where you don't separate out the derivatives. You're going to get some arbitrary results because you can't separate out the effect of the derivative from the effect of the host liability. And you have to decide, are you going to sort of follow the treatment for the host, or are you going to follow the treatment for the derivative? And we just thought it made sense to follow the treatment for the host. And we were wanting to try and avoid complexity in requirements that will be in a very general standard that everybody's going to have to get to grips with. And we were hoping to make it a standard that you could read and understand. But I agree, Sue has raised questions, you know, examples that I had not thought about. So maybe it's something we need to consider further. But I think it is a balance between, you know, complexity and chasing down, you know, increasingly complicated items.
But can I just respond, Andreas? I just worry that we are kidding ourselves that it's going to be an easier route, because if you gave me half an hour, I reckon I could come up with 10 examples of where I'd have a real debate with you about whether it's interest and interest related. And so, whereas if we were to say, for closely related stuff that's got closely related derivatives that's measured at amortized cost, and if we're comfortable to rely on that filter, then it's just very simple. Everything that hits P&L is in the financing section. It's and I really think that's a convenient filter that could just really simplify it. And it's simplified. It's harder to draft. I get that it's an extra thing and it's, you know, it's a pain in the neck. But once people understand what it means, I think it'll be easier to actually implement and understand and have less application questions and also less logistics questions, because otherwise you're going to start slicing and dicing pieces of amortized cost accounting.
Yeah, I'm with Sue on this one. Nick, please.
Thanks. I just wanted to reflect on, you know, the kind of genesis of these requirements that we have here, which was really to seek to address, I guess, a long-standing frustration about the ambiguity of some items in terms of where users find those today, whether they are in operating or in financing. And certainly, you know, I've focused on up until now are the interest element around pension liabilities and those on, for instance, decommissioning liabilities. But I think the principle of trying to ensure that interest and interest-related items are not included in operating and that we get this so-called clean operating number, and that they are in financing is clearly very close to what it is at the heart of the user ask here.
Could I just ask a question of Sue, and it may just demonstrate my ignorance of the sort of separation criteria. Are you talking about just where the embedded derivative is closely related, or where it's not separated because it wouldn't be a standalone derivative if it were on its own?
I talked earlier about the ones that are separable, but where they've chosen to keep them together. That's the funky derivatives, to use my terminology. I'm only talking now about closely related derivatives. So this is things that are benign enough that we're comfortable in our literature to say it's fine to just include them in your amortized cost mechanics. So it's the things that have been screened through the embedded derivative criteria in 9 as being, you know, things you'd naturally expect to see in a financial instrument. It's, you know, inflation but without leverage. It's normal prepayment features. It's, you know, pretty benign stuff.
Thanks. Bruce, please.
Thanks very much. I mean, I guess the challenge I have with this is that you want to end up with a standard that's not too complex for people to apply. But on the other hand, I also want to end up with a standard I think gives the right answer. I guess thinking about what Sue's been saying and kind of where we would put these things, I mean, to me, intuitively, if you'd sat down and asked me up front where these things should go without looking at the proposals, I would have put those in financing just by the nature of the instruments. And I guess the fact that, as we're saying, these are things that we're putting that the embeddeds are not being split out in. Can I make a suggestion? I mean, maybe the idea as a way forward on this is to flesh out a bit an example of what that would look like. So the one thing I always find when we start getting into the detail of these questions is I think maybe we haven't really thought about how this is going to impact on each part of it. And it just gives people ability to kind of take a look and see exactly how that would impact on the numbers and make sure everybody's talking from the same hymn sheet in terms of those things. I mean, from our point of view, I do have a lot of sympathy for thinking we should put these into financing, but I also have sympathy and understanding that if we do that, we've got to then write the standard around a situation which allows things to get in there. And I guess I can see that complexity could result in us creating kind of rules in which people can start working around. And that always worries me. So I do appreciate what Sue's saying, and I think I have a lot of sympathy for that argument. I guess my debate would be I'd like to see the wording that's going to get us in there that's not going to create a problem on the other side. So maybe that's a challenge to the staff.
Okay, any further comments? Don't see that. So yes, please, Mary.
Sorry, I was just going to say I've been really scrambling and pulling out my copy of IFRS 9 to go back and read.
I think you're on mute, Mary.
Sorry.
Thank you. I had to go back and pull out my copy of IFRS9 to go back and look at the guidance on separation of embedded derivatives, because I can't do intuitively what Sue can, which is to be able to see that these things are the benign ones as opposed to some of the really funky ones that don't qualify as embedded derivatives, which is what was going through my mind. The reason I'm going through all this, oh, woe is me, I had to do some IFRS 9 research, is I think Sue's point has merit. And while I think overall the staff has made great progress in moving us forward to some clear guidelines, I really, when I think about that prepayment option example as the type of thing that would survive the filter of what requires separation, that's in paragraph 4.3.3 of IFRS 9, I would like to explore further thinking about that specific subset, because we can tie it to an existing criterion that's in another standard, as opposed to we're writing something only for the purpose of the presentation requirements. So I think it is something I don't know how to vote. I guess I'm asking Andres for guidance on how to vote if I want to explore Sue's suggestion further, in light of the question four.
My comment was exactly to that point, to say probably it doesn't make sense to me to have a vote on that question, given the comments that Sue has made and that you have also now made. But Sue wanted to come back, I understand.
Yeah. I wonder whether we could vote on question four for everything except this little population, because that would at least give the staff hope that they've moved forward, and I know how hard they've worked on this issue. And it really is, I'm sorry, I feel very like I'm being very disruptive, but I just think I can just foresee the questions coming to the Interpretations Committee that I'm not going to be able to answer, because we know this is a live area of complexity. In, you know, this goes back to the discussion we had yesterday on amortized cost mechanics and IFRS 9. It's all linked into that as well. But this is a small population I'm talking about. I'm talking about situations of, you know, supplier financing, the truck example, blah, blah, blah. It's a small population, but I think in that population, it will be very common that you'll be in this category, because they're pretty likely to have some of these benign features. So I would like to just see whether we could make it. I think we can define the population relatively neatly. Mary's point is exactly why I'm sort of comfortable suggesting it. It's a known population. We don't have, you can sort of point to the paragraph in IFRS 9 and say, potentially for this small subset of things in the small not only financing category, just put everything into financing. For everything else, do what's in question four. And I just think that's not a huge big deal in terms of drafting. I think it will work. Let's make sure it does. But I think we could vote on question four, absent that tiny little closely related population.
I think that's a great idea, Sue. I'd be very happy to take a vote on everything apart from these non-separated embedded derivatives, and we'll do more work on them. That's fine.
Okay. Aida, do you want to come in before we vote on that?
Yeah, maybe. I'm not sure that this is helpful at all, but I guess for us, the main point is, and recognizing when we are being inconsistent, not because conceptually it is the right answer, but because the standards are basically drafted differently, and this is what outcomes. And specifically, I'm thinking now, trying to contrast this with IS 37 situation, and you know, where we don't have that much specificity, and are we being so prescriptive here potentially, simply because IFRS 9 gives us opportunity to do so. And just, you know, so I guess I'm saying we just need maybe a little bit of time to go back and just think through to make sure we're comfortable, because the basis, to my mind, will be important as to, you know, why we are quite specific, very specific in some aspects, and in other aspects are perhaps letting things go, as Anne explained. I also want to ask a question in relation to these, like to me, just example of prepayment option does sound very common, but just linking back to the comments you made earlier, Andreas and Rika, in terms of importance of just having a look at this whole package to make sure we don't get unintended consequences. And I wonder whether this should be also part of that package we're going to go and look at and discuss with people in practice before we go back with specific drafting on the scope and for this exception that we're just discussing now.
So would the recommendation be that we don't take a vote on this question now and let you first do further research? I would think, similar to Sue, that this is really a rather safe ground, because I think the exception is not, may look like a breach in principle from your standards perspective, but it is an exception that we already have in our literature. And I think that's the only reason and justification for it. The exception companies have to go through in order to establish recognition and measurement. So therefore, you could then say, okay, it seems just logical, if you have come to a conclusion, to just take that conclusion forward, even when it comes to classifying income and expenses or gains and losses on these instruments as financing or operating. So I was happy with Sue's suggestion and saying, let's stick to how the question is asked, but only make an exception for non-separable embedded derivatives as per IFRS 9. But if you say you want to do a bit more research, just let me know. I mean. Question is, I'm happy to vote on this, but I'm also happy to vote in September.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm not saying we shouldn't vote if the board feels comfortable with going ahead. All I'm saying is that, you know, if you think it's a good idea, we'll probably like to just go back and test this as well as testing that we do on other parts, just to make sure we haven't created any unintended consequences somewhere else. That's all.
Understood. Rika, you wanted to come in.
Oh, yes. I just give some encouragement to the project team staff, because I think this is a kind of a good response to the feedback we received negatively about what we proposed in the exposure draft, especially about entity has a concern about population. Should be captured by the exposure draft. And probably it's sometimes difficult for the entity to fully identify the item and how can they get comfortable with the outcome of the population that they identified. And at the same time, how to measure the amount without any IFRS standards require them to calculate or determine those amounts. So I thought this is a great response to that kind of the concern we had from the stakeholder. So excluding the Sue's narrow scope point, I think I fully support the staff recommend here.
So can I just see and test the water, see how board members react? So the proposal is, if you go back to paragraph 56, where you see the entirety of the products. The change that Sue proposes is really in relation to little d. So it is financial liabilities that do have embedded derivatives that do not need to be bifurcated. Treat all income and expenses out of those instruments as financing. That's the requirement.
When they're measured at amortized cost.
Yeah, that's an important addition, right? So can I see who would support that? So follow the recommendation of the staff as per question 4, with the exception of financial liabilities that are measured at amortized cost that do contain an embedded derivative, but that derivative does not need to be separated and have all gains and losses included in financing. Can I see who would support that?
Twelve.
There you go. All right. Thank you very much. I think that brings us to the end of paper 21A, unless I see Anne nodding. That's good. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. That's great. Oh. Thank you.
Okay. I suggest that we probably pull forward the break now, because we only have 15 minutes. The question would be otherwise whether we take paper 21B now. But I suppose it will probably make more sense to have that after the break. I'm looking to Aida here and have 21B and C discussed in one go. I see her nodding. Okay. So then can I suggest that we break for lunch and reconvene at 2:15, please? Thank you.